This is The After Party, live with Kim McAllister. Pick a couch, grab a drink, and settle into the conversation.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to The After Party Live. It is a weird day. We had a medical issue on the Mark Thompson show, which delayed our start. And then, you know, this show starts when that one ends. So I'm so sorry that we're getting a delayed start, but it was just kind of the situation today. Really, really appreciate you being here. If you could right off the bat, click that like button as people trickle over from the Mark Thompson show, I would so appreciate it. Again, please click the like button. And if you haven't subscribed, boy, I'm pushing 1900. I know it's not like the 30,000 on the Mark Thompson show, but I'm so excited to be edging ever closer to 1900 subscribers and then maybe 2000. So it's, you know, the little show that could. We're just going to keep on going until we get this thing off the ground and see if we can't grow it a little bit. So thank you. And thank you to everyone who has contributed to the show PayPal account. Really, really appreciate that as well. Find the information in the show description and the About tab on YouTube about the show and also in the show description every day. Okay, enough about that. Let's get right to the story so I can make sure that we get enough. Good afternoon. Appreciate you too, Doug. Thanks for being here. Hey, Jim. Nice. Audio only for Ricky. That's all right. However you're listening. By the way, don't know if you guys knew this, but this show, as Mark Thompson show and the Nicki Maduro show in its new format as well, all are available via podcast. So if you can't catch the YouTube version with the video, you can find them on the Google Podcast, the Apple Podcast, the Spreaker, whatever podcast platform you listen to. The chances are very good that if you type in the Nicki Maduro show, the Mark Thompson show, or the After Party Live, you'll find us in the audio only version that way. And thank you to the folks who listen that way as well. Okay. Let's move right into the show because I don't know if you guys saw this story, but I thought it's pretty weird. Most of the time when you hear about art issues at a museum, it's someone stealing something, right? Not this time. In this particular situation, it was an artist smuggling their painting in. Apparently, that's not okay either. No, you have to go through the proper channels with all of this. This employee quietly snuck his own painting right onto the wall of a museum in Germany. This is at the Pinakothek de Modern. So it's a modern art museum in Germany. And this person was an employee of the museum and they were tasked with taking apart displays and putting up displays, so working with drills, you know, doing the labor intensive work that is required when you put one of these exhibits together or take them apart. But apparently this was just a day job for this person because really by night they were an artist. And apparently because he had this job with, you know, working to take apart and put together displays, had access to the museum even during off hours. And so apparently on a Saturday when the museum was not open, snuck his own painting into the museum and hung it on the gallery wall. The 51-year-old man, he thought this would be his artistic breakthrough. Instead, he could be facing some prison time. This comes from the Smithsonian Magazine. The employee considered himself an artist and most likely saw his role in the museum's installation team as a day job to support his true calling. This is a spokesperson for the museum talking to The Guardian. So this Pinakothek der Modern has some pretty famous artists gracing the walls. Picasso, Klee, Warhol. It's got 20,000 works, one of the largest modern art museums in Germany. And because of the nature of this man's job, he had access to the gallery even when it was closed. So he was helping install an exhibition on architecture and philanthropy, which is when he was carrying tools, went completely unnoticed, and he was able to move around all areas of the building outside of opening hours. His painting that he put on the wall was pretty big, 24 by 47 inches. So he attaches it to the exhibition wall with two screws, leaving behind drill holes, And the staff at the museum were quickly like, what is that? That is not something that we had approved to have on the museum wall. But they left it there until the end of the day. And then they're like, no, they took it down. Not a lot of damage because of the screw holes in the wall. They call the damage about $107. The picture has been removed. It's been confiscated. But the museum called the police. And so apparently there could be a little bit of jail time because of sneaking the art onto the wall here. There was a similar situation that happened at a different museum in Germany, in Bonn, Germany, where a student used double-sided tape to stick one of her paintings onto a gallery wall. And the staff there didn't notice the painting until they took down the exhibition that it was hanging in. They said they thought it was funny. They wanted to get to know the artist. They told her to get in touch. There's no trouble. Word of honor. But for this situation in Munich, not so much. They are not as lighthearted about this whole thing. The employee confessed his actions via email after the painting was discovered. The museum fired him and reported his actions to police. So he's under investigation for the $100 in property damage. And if he's convicted, get this, he could face up to 2 years in prison. 2 years for that? Wow. I don't think that's what he had planned when he had, you know, put his painting on the wall. I don't know. I mean, I guess you're hurting the integrity of the museum, right? One could argue that, you know, the museum has something to present and a voice to display. And if you go in and start putting random art on the walls, you're hurting the quality of what people will see at the museum. I guess you could argue that. But it just seems a little, I don't know, a little rough to me. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Enough of that. So there is an animal story that I wanted to share with you. And Animals Today, sponsored by Janet R. Animals like bears are coming out of hibernation. And so we're seeing a lot more bear stories pop up. And here's one that I found where you've seen this before, where bears are attracted to cars. And I think the funny part about this one is, you know, is there donuts in this squad car? I don't know. But check this out. This is a bear who is very, very curious about this squad car. Look at him trying to get in there. What are there, donuts in there? What's going on? So the police department, the state trooper, puts out a wanted poster, suspect description, name unknown, address unknown, alias Teddy, weight 500 plus pounds, as he goes in there. He's just trying to sniff out what's in the car. I mean, who knows what's in there? Could be something good. There he is. So we've seen them, what? Sniff out a police car just in the last few days, swim at a pool in Burbank, right? All these things. So I think it's a good reminder that they're waking up, and in communities where these creatures are located, you're going to see more of them. I know this is not necessarily what everybody wants to talk about all the time, but I feel like this is really important because there are a lot of people, not just women, people that suffer from urinary tract infections all the time. And there's apparently a new oral vaccine that could be a potential alternative to antibiotics for people who get these in a recurring fashion. And so they've done this study with this vaccine, and it turns out that more than half of patients with recurring UTIs, 54%, wound up infection-free for 9 years after receiving this oral spray vaccine. It had no notable side effects, according to researchers. Before having the vaccine, all the participants in the study suffered from UTIs recurrent. And for many women, especially, it can be difficult to treat, right? It can end up with a bladder infection. It can spread. So 9 years after receiving this new UTI vaccine, about half of the participants remained infection-free. The researchers say overall the vaccine is safe in the long term. The participants reported having fewer UTIs that were less severe, and many who did get a UTI told researchers that simply drinking plenty of water was enough to treat it. The medicine is developed by this Spanish pharmaceutical company called Immunotech, and it's the MV140 vaccine. It has four bacterial species in a pineapple-flavored suspension of water. And remember, it's an oral spritz, right? The vaccine is administered with two spritzes under the tongue every day for 3 months. So it has to taste at least decent. So it tastes like, I guess what, pineapple juice? Two spritzes under the tongue every day for 3 months. I would say if you're someone that has this, because I know people that have recurrent issues with this, that would be a small price to pay. So if that really works, it was a 9-year follow-up study. Researchers analyzed the health records of 89 participants and interviewed them. Of the group, 48 remained entirely infection-free during the entire 9-year follow-up. The average infection-free period across the entire group, 4.5 years for women, 3.5 years for men. About 40% of participants reported having repeat doses of the vaccine after 1 or 2 years. They call the results very promising. That UTIs are a substantial economic burden. Overuse of antibiotic treatments can lead to antibiotic-resistant infections. So this could be a good deal. They're still researching this, but gosh, that's kind of good, I would say. Did you hear about the Disney cabins in Florida? The Disney cabins, Disney is redoing things at Disney World. And they have these cabins you could stay in. They're a little bit rustic. I think they look really nice. They're the Fort Wilderness cabins. And they're redoing everything. They're making everything more modern. They're changing it all up. And they're selling these. So if you want to own, Wes, are you hearing me? If you want to own a piece of Disney history, they're now selling these cabins that were once at the Disney's Fort Wilderness Resort and Campground. Dream Life Mobile Homes has these cabins listed on the website and Facebook Marketplace. They're about 500 square feet. They're fully furnished. They have one bedroom and one bathroom, sleep up to 6 people in there. The units were built between 1998 and 2001, so not so long, right? There are multiple cabins available. The folks at Dream Life Mobile Homes say they could be a great investment property option for an Airbnb, a VRBO, a tiny home resort, a rental, a lot of other possibilities. Each cabin will need to have its deck, stairs, and side skirting replaced. So the deck you see there, that won't come with it. They're $50,000, $49,900. And they'll deliver it to you free within 25 miles of Orlando. Otherwise, you have to pay to have it delivered. But what a cool thing to have a piece of, I don't know, Disneyland, Disney World. You know, if someone comes to stay at your house, if you have enough land in your backyard or whatever to put a little ADU in, a little cabin in. Oh, what a cute cabin. Oh, thank you. It used to be at Disney World. What? Anyway, I thought that was kind of cool. Last year, Walt Disney World announced it planned to refresh the cabin hideaways at Disney's Fort Wilderness Resort and Campground. They're replacing the existing cabins at the resort with 350 new cabins. So I'm sure they'll be nice, but these really don't look that bad at all, and they're not that old. So if you were maybe someone who lived near the Orlando area, could get this delivered for free, maybe you were looking to put an ADU on your property anyway, great deal. That's really cool. There's a, you know, I love a good historical find. There's another one. A Pompeii find. Look at that. You see that the drawings on the sides of the walls? Here's a close-up of the drawings or the art, the paintings there. Pretty cool. This is stunning frescoes of mythological characters that were uncovered in this area of Pompeii. And again, here's what it looked like, right? The area that they've uncovered. You can see the walls here. And again, the close-up. Pretty special. That's beautiful. Ancient Romans, apparently, enjoying more than just food during their feasts. Archaeologists working at the world-famous site in Pompeii discovering a banqueting hall with black-painted walls covered with frescoes of mythological characters associated with the Trojan War. This was an ornately decorated room which provided an elegant setting for entertainment or conversation during banquets. The Archaeological Park of Pompeii, overseeing this site, is saying, yeah, this is the banquet hall. Now, it doesn't look very big to me for a banquet hall. Here again, here's the main thing. But I guess, can you picture it? Filled with tables and people drinking and eating. Kind of cool. Just to think back about people in that age. So one of the frescoes shows Cassandra, the daughter of Priam, with the god Apollo. As legend has it, Apollo promised Cassandra the gift of prophecy, but as she did not yield to his desires, punished her by also ordaining that her prophecies would never be believed. Her warning of the fall of Troy went unheeded. This is a newly revealed dining room. It's about 49 feet long, 20 feet wide, opens up to a courtyard with a long staircase leading to a second floor. On the fresh plaster of the arches of the staircase, someone used charcoal to draw two pairs of gladiators and what seemed to be a huge stylized phallus as well. There were large piles of building materials found beneath the arches as well. So interesting. It seems like so much is found. Every time you turn around, they find something else incredible in Pompeii. Really cool. Do you want to help save from the culture to the not so much? Do you want to help save Beer Can Island? Well, you can help save Beer Can Island. As a matter of fact, you can own a little bitty piece of part of it. There's a project to save Florida's Beer Can Island offering partial ownership of it for $1,000. I've never been to Beer Can Island. I don't know if it's like, are there beer cans everywhere? Does it look like a trashy place? I don't know. Let's take a look. Look at Beer Can Island. Pretty nice. I don't see any beer cans, do you? No. This project to save Florida's Beer Can Island offers a partial ownership, they say, for just about $1,000. So, I don't know. Let's see if I can't make it bigger. There it is. Look at that. That's beautiful. I'm going to start it over so you can check it out. Ooh, look. So pretty. Pretty nice. Pretty small. I could see wanting to save Beer Can Island. I guess it's a nice little party place. Tiny little island, right? Yeah. This is a small Florida key known as Beer Can Island because of so many parties thrown there. So the area's for sale. One prospective buyer is looking for partners to go in at $1,000 a piece. It's a 9-acre island. It's also known as Pine Key. It's located right near MacDill Air Force Base and Apollo Beach. And it was created in the 1940s as a result of all the dredging in this area. They took sand and relocated it from other materials from construction sites. And what you have here is Beer Can Island. It was planted with Australian pine trees to help prevent erosion. And because it had been littered with empty beer cans from decades of parties, they do call it Beer Can Island. It was purchased by four friends in 2017. They scooped out about 300 to 400 bags worth of trash from this property, and the owners ended up installing other attractions. Like a giant slide, portable bathrooms. They put in a tiki bar to attract people here. And it was successful for a time, but they decided to close this island down because of the long work hours required to maintain it. They also had to deal with the cost of repairing damage done by Hurricane Idalia. The quote is, If I had an extra $10 million to dump into it, I would beautify the place even more. But I don't have the resources for it. And so I live an hour and a half away. Getting over there is a chore. It's even worse coming home at the end of the night. I'll head out there at 6 a.m. Usually don't get out of there till 9 o'clock. So it was originally listed for more than $14 million, this beer can island. But one prospective buyer announced Save Beer Can Island's project that would allow other members of the public to buy a stake in the island for just $1,000 each. The money pledged by participants is being kept in an escrow account and will be returned if the group fails to buy the island. He said any money left over after buying it would be spent on taxes and legal fees, the cost of a website, and other maintenance costs for the island. He said, I don't think too many people are going to go out and buy a whole island. So he said there's an opportunity for all of us to own an island together, which could be a pretty neat opportunity. So everyone that pays $1,000 for this project will have the opportunity to vote on issues, including whether the island will be open to the public, what should be installed at the site, all of these things. What a novel concept or thought, way to save an island that is important to you. Kind of cool. And again, who's going to own an island? Maybe owning $1,000 worth of it is a fun thing to do if you have an extra grand sitting around. This lady was making cookies when the diamond fell out of her ring. Uh-oh, it's happened before. But this lady is a baker. She owns this bakery. And she's asking her customers, eat your cookies really carefully, because she'd really like the $4,000 diamond back from her ring. She lost it in the dough. Her name is Dawn. She's the owner of Sis Sweets Cookies and Cafe in Leavenworth, Kansas. And the diamond fell out of that ring that has been on her finger for 36 years. Happened at some point while she was making these cookies. She said, we went back to the kitchen and looked around. She's afraid that the diamond ended up in the cookie dough. And she said, if you happen to find it, I would be forever in your debt if you would return it. Can you imagine biting into a diamond? I mean, she'll be lucky if she doesn't have to pay someone's dental bills. Man, that's a big thing. Let's take a look at the video on this one. Here, I have it for you. Here it is.
Chewing softly, KMEC 9's Alan Shope explains.
I look down at my hand and the center diamond is gone.
Workers at Sis Sweets in Leavenworth put on and take off more than 119,000 rubber gloves every year, but never had this happen.
Banging the bowls and the pans.
A wedding ring from nearly four decades ago, chosen by her husband, now missing the main headpiece diamond.
So we kind of went back to the kitchen and looked around.
But the huge diamond was gone.
I was crying and all he could say is, you still have me. So. That made it all better.
Sis says somewhere between rolling dough and making cookies on Friday, the center diamond dropped into the dough.
It's 36 years on this hand.
She says they've narrowed the search to either chocolate chip, sugar, or peanut butter cookies, and they put out a plea to their customers. Use caution before biting into one.
Mainly because I didn't want anybody to break a tooth.
Sis says she hopes to find the diamond, but she acknowledges if she doesn't, she'll just have to replace it because she says the ring is far too valuable to her to take off her finger.
I cried. I cried a lot.
But 4 days later, no luck. So while Sis Sweets continues to pump out the pastries, they're still holding out hope the missing diamond will show up. And she says, who knows, there might be a ton of free cookies for anyone that finds
it. But I would definitely make it worth your while bringing it back.
In Leavenworth, Alan Shope, KMBC 9 News.
Can you imagine? Man, let's talk about nature and the cities that do best in a new nature quest study. Look at that, Alamo Square in San Francisco. It looks like spending time in nature, of course, has increased health benefits. It lowers your anxiety levels. You can think more clearly. It apparently even lowers your risk for heart disease. Maybe that's because you're out in the world exercising and moving around. But for people who live in cities, in dense urban areas, access to nature and greenery, other than your neighborhood park, can be a little difficult. So this analysis was done by the Washington Post, showing which cities in the United States have the best access to nature. And the results for California weren't so good. This is called Nature Score, and it's a new tool from an Oregon-based research institution called Nature Quant. and they looked at about 30 environmental factors, like the amount of quality in tree canopy, noise and light pollution, area parkland. And they assigned cities a score from 1 to 100. 1 is the worst, and 100 is the best when it comes to access to nature for your health. The score used to figure out how to improve nature access in some places and how nature affects health in humans. So San Francisco, which has, you know, a lot of parks, right? It was, what they say, every person in San Francisco lives within a 10-minute walk to a park. And it's true. There are parks in every neighborhood. They had about an average score. They got a nature score in the city of 52.3. Better than Chicago, better than Los Angeles, but worse than Boston and Washington, D.C. So for every square mile in San Francisco, there's 11,466 people. And maybe there's not enough access to greenery or nature in this area. One of the worst scores in the country, though, shows up in Southern California, Los Angeles, doing really, really badly when it comes to this nature list. Yeah. They say it has a nature score of 23.5. Yikes. Some of the problems here, La Sombrita, this is part of the city that they didn't even have shade at bus stops. Carson, a small city north of Long Beach in Los Angeles County, has the sprawling industrial complex. It had one of the lowest nature scores at 2.9. So the Los Angeles area as a whole does not do well on the nature score. The more densely populated the city is, the less likely it is to have a high nature score. So the small city of Suffolk, Virginia, which has just 147 people per square mile, had the highest nature score in the country. More access to nature for people than anywhere else. Union City, New Jersey, the densest in the city on the list, 30,000 people per square mile, had one of the worst. The Post also used the tool to compare nature scores with 2020 socioeconomic data from the U.S. Census Bureau. Areas that are poorer, less educated, and less white, they said, had on average less exposure to nature than those which were richer, more educated, and had a higher percentage of white people. Oh, so nature's just for white people, is that it? Got it. Just another one of these studies that show, you know, why we're not focusing on making sure that everyone has access to the same types of things. You see it with, you know, why we put, we as a society, put these refineries in areas that are socioeconomically disadvantaged. So here's a story. Lighten it up a little bit. Sorry, I know it's a party. This is a story about the Beard and Mustache Championship. They've claimed 3 facial hair chain world records. I know I'm going to get demonetized for this, but since I'm already demonetized anyway, maybe that's the way of the world. This is an annual event. It's held in different locations every year by Beard Team USA. And this time it was in Florida. They broke 3 Guinness World Records for the longest chain of beards and mustaches and partial beards. This is, it's pretty wild. They tied them all together like a chain. And you could see them going on and on and on and on. They first attempted this record for the longest beard chain, previously set at 150 feet during the previous year's National Beard and Mustache Champions. So the beard sporting participants stand side by side, their facial hair clipped together into an 86-long person chain, measuring 195 feet and 3 inches. So then they attempt the record for the longest mustache chain, with 27 people involved, and it's a record-breaking length of 20 feet and 4 inches. Can you imagine having your mustaches clipped together like this? Crazy. The final record, the longest partial beard chain, involved only those participants with partial beard styles, which include mutton chops, goatees, and musketeer-style facial hair. The partial beard chain, made up of 24 participants, measured 42 feet and 8 inches long. So all three record attempts are successful. It looks extra crazy because it's so wacky to even make a beard chain in the first place. The creative director for Beard Team USA tells Guinness World Records, the measuring, documenting, and all of the official aspects of certifying the record title for Guinness World Records just adds to the whole thing. So I was going to play you the video, but it's not popping up. Absolutely nuts. Oh, okay, I do have it. Okay. Yeah, it's pretty crazy stuff. I don't know. They have to stand not so close to each other. Well, here's some pictures of it. I'll show you you don't really get the full like length of it in this shot, but at least you can kind of see how they have to be clipped together like this. I don't know. I don't think my husband would stand clipped together to another person, although he does have a little beard. Here it is. Look at them all. So you got the full beards, you got the mustache guys, you got the partial beard guys, and the record set for all three categories. Congratulations to the facial hair guys. Look at that. Well done, and way to go. Okay, let's move on to this one. This is supposed to be the brightest light of all time. I am, you know, fascinated by these space stories. This is a gamma ray burst caused by an exploding star. And it has, apparently, shown us the brightest light ever seen. So let's see if I can get this for you. Let's see if I can. Well, maybe I'll share my screen with you. But it's beautiful. The picture is beautiful. The scientists at Northwestern University are confirming the cause of the brightest gamma ray burst ever observed and pictured 1 to 2 months afterward was the destruction of a star known as a supernova, and it was 2.4 billion light years away. I mean, it's just so, so beautiful. I can't imagine looking at that and knowing that you just saw a star explode. So cool. All right, see if I can't. For some reason, it doesn't like it. Oh, here it is. Okay, here's what it looks like. Check this out. You kind of see a little circle in the picture as well. See that? The bright light in the middle that's circled? Yeah, that's what it looks like. The team discovers from Northwestern, that the phenomenon responsible for this historic burst of electromagnetic radiation, called the brightest of all time, is the collapse and then the subsequent explosion of this massive star. They saw it using the James Webb Space Telescope. Pretty cool. They'd been unable to uncover the cause until now, because the once in 10,000 year event was so bright, 10 times brighter than any previously seen gamma ray burst. But they were able to detect the supernova behind the burst by studying its aftermath with this James Webb telescope 6 months afterward. It was so bright that it obscured any potential supernova signature in the first weeks and months after the burst. The afterglow of the burst was of the gamma ray burst was like the headlight of a car coming straight at you. So you couldn't even, that prevents you just from seeing the car itself. Same thing here, where you couldn't really see anything except the bright light. So they had to wait for this to fade significantly to give researchers the chance of seeing the supernova. They were able to observe the signature left by calcium and oxygen elements that occur within supernovas by viewing light at the infrared end of the light spectrum via the James Webb's near-infrared spectrograph. And they found that it was nowhere as bright as expected given the gamma radiation that was coming from it. They said it's not brighter than previous supernovae. It looked fairly normal in the context of others associated with less energetic gamma ray bursts. The researcher said you might expect that the same collapsing star producing a very energetic and bright gamma ray burst would also produce a very energetic and bright supernova. But it turns out that's not the case, that we have this extremely luminous gamma ray burst, but a very normal looking supernova. So, interesting. Beautiful though, isn't it? Love to look at that. I guess it was just a regular old supernova after all. What a bummer. He would have thought it would have been something extra special. I have another space story for you. This one about baby stars. And while they're forming, it turns out they kind of sneeze. It's a star sneeze, is what researchers are calling it. I have to ask Professor Fracknoy about this one. But baby stars, I guess, have to emit some materials. And when they do it, they call it a star sneeze. Kind of cute. Here it is. Here's a diagram of it, I should say, is what it looks like. Yeah, a little star sneeze, just a little sneeze. The researchers say just like bodies can sometimes forcefully expel dust in our noses in the form of a sneeze, a similar phenomenon may be happening in baby stars. The new observations of the protostellar disk that surrounds a baby star offer a closer look at how the disk releases plumes of gas, electromagnetic energy, and dust. This team from Kyushu University in Japan describes these sneezes as a release of magnetic flux or energy that could be a vital part of the formation of this star. They've published their findings in the April 11th version of the Astrophysical Journal. All stars, they say, develop in stellar nurseries. But the star formation is a very complicated process that they still don't completely understand. The large areas of space that are full of raw material needed to create stars, gas, dust, and energy. Stellar nurseries, they say, with large concentrations of dust and gas eventually condense, forming a stellar core or a baby star. Over the time, the stellar cores will accumulate more material and grow in mass, and as this growth continues, dust and gas form a ring around the new star that astronomers call the protostellar disk. The structures are penetrated by magnetic fields, which brings with it magnetic flux. If all the magnetic flux were retained as the star developed, it would generate magnetic fields many order of magnitude stronger than those observed in any known protostar. So scientists are hypothesizing that some of the mechanisms during star development to remove that magnetic flux is that over time, the magnetic field gradually weakens and the cloud is pulled into the stellar core. Little sneezes, little baby star sneeze. Wait, they said they analyzed their data and they found something pretty unique. There were these spike-like structures extending a few astronomical units from the protostellar disk. And as they dug in deeper, they found they were spikes of expelled magnetic flux, dust, and gas. They call it, technically, not a baby star sneeze, interchange instability. When instabilities in the magnetic field react with different amounts of gas in the protostellar disk surrounding the baby star, and the result is the expulsion of magnetic flux. We dubbed it a baby star sneeze, as it reminded us of when we expelled dust and air at high speeds. So there you have it, a little baby star sneeze. Kind of cute. Speaking of space stuff, did you hear that starting today, the Lyrid meteor shower is beginning? Now, maybe it's not as cool as what everyone experienced with the complete eclipse, right? But it's another opportunity, especially if you have a kid like mine who loves space stuff, to go outside and take a look at these meteors. Now, it's going on all month, but apparently it doesn't really peak until around April 20th, 21st, the Lyrid meteor shower. They say from April 15th, so today, through April 29th, and the spectacle peaks between April 21st and 22nd. So, you know, when you see a meteor shower. It's like a shooting star, bright streaks in the sky. And again, maybe not as exciting as a solar eclipse, but still pretty cool. This happens every year, mid to late April. The Lyrid meteor shower produces about 10 to 20 bright, fast meteors per hour at its peak. They have been known to produce heavier showers, up to 100 per hour. The Lyrids will run from April 15th through the 29th, again, the peak taking place the evening of April 21st into the early morning hours of the 22nd. So, if you are hoping to catch them, that is the best time to see them. If you are, they give you tips here. They give us some tips. If you're hoping to catch a glimpse of a shooting star or two during the Lyrids, they say all you need to do is head outside after dark and look up. If you, though, want to improve your visibility, go to an area with less light pollution. So if you live in a city where, you know, stars don't shine as bright, maybe head out to the country where you get a little bit better view. They have certified dark sky spaces now. I think they have one in Marin, maybe out at Point Reyes. I heard they were trying to put one there. A national park or some other wilderness area. They say wear warm clothes, bring a chair that lets you recline comfortably, or a blanket that you can lie down on the ground, and plan to spend about 30 to 60 minutes looking at the night sky. Give your eyes 20 to 30 minutes to adjust to the darkness, and try to use red lights instead of white lights whenever possible. So you should try to avoid looking at your phone screen before and during your meteor watching. And they say you might be tempted to stare in the direction of the Lyra constellation, but experts say let your eyes roam around the sky and keep your eyes peeled for fireballs or occasional bright flashes produced by the Lyrids. That it's actually better to view the Lyrids away from their radiant. They will appear longer and more spectacular from that perspective. If you do look directly at the radiant or the Lyrid, you'll find the meteors will be short. And it's a effect of perspective called foreshortening. So that's it. If you're going to go check them out. The Lyrids are one of the oldest known meteor showers. Astronomers in China spotted them and made the first recorded observations of Lyrid meteors in 687 BCE. So that means we've been looking at these cool things for 2,700 years. Kind of cool. The Lyrids happen when the Earth passes through the debris field of a comet. In this case, it's the comet C1861 G1 Thacher. It's named for A.E. Thacher, an amateur astronomer who first observed it in modern times, I guess, April 5th of 1861. It takes the comet more than 415 years to complete a full orbit. And the drawn-out journey means the year of its discovery, 1861, was also the last time the comet Thacher made its closest approach to the sun. The next time Thacher will re-enter the inner solar system will be around the year 2278, that according to Earth Sky. So kind of cool. Last story, and I know I'm going a little bit long today, but that's because everything got kind of bumped back. The last story I wanted to share with you today was about this massive kangaroo. And I mean, this guy, he's huge. He's not around anymore, but he's a pretty big kanga. I have to tell you. Interesting. Here's an artist's rendering of what things may have looked like way back when. This super kanga in New Zealand, they had apparently giant lemurs, large marine reptiles. Paleontologists now finding evidence of three unusual new species of giant fossil kangaroo in present-day Australia and New Guinea as well. These creatures are described in a study, the journal Megataxa. They indicate these species were likely much more diverse in terms of shape, range of habitat, and hopping method as well. The living kangaroos are already pretty remarkable. So it's amazing to think what these peculiar giant kangaroos could have been getting up to. That's the quote from the study co-author at Flinders University. Kind of interesting. The three new species belong to an extinct genus of giant kangaroo called Protemnodon that lived about 5 million to 40,000 years ago. They would have looked similar to modern gray kangaroos, but they were generally more squat and muscular. Some species were about 110 pounds, others twice as large as today's biggest living kangaroos. They have historically been found as individual bones instead of in complete skeletons, and it made it difficult for scientists to figure out just how many species there were and how they differed in geographic range, in movement, in size. The fossils of this genus are widespread. They're found regularly, but more often than not, you have no way of being certain which species it is that you're actually looking at. So for this study, the team was able to use multiple complete fossilized kangaroo skeletons from Lake Kayabana in South Australia. And that helped them get a bigger picture of these big kangaroos. They said they're all different from one another, that they lived and adapted in different environments, and they even had very different methods of hopping. I have another picture I want to show you of kind of the difference between the modern day kangaroos and the kangaroos that they're talking about. I mean, these things are huge. If you think about how a kangaroo can kick someone, right, and have been known to hurt people, check out the giant kangaroo. So what you have here on the far right is the eastern gray kangaroo. And then you look at the biggest one, the Protemnodon. That's a big, big kangaroo. So again, they were more muscular, stronger, bigger, everything. Hey, interesting. And that's what they found. So again, they've just published a new study on these giant kangaroos. I find it fascinating. Well, that's what I've got for you guys today. And I don't want to keep you too long, but thank you for being here with me on the After Party Live. Hopefully you can click the like button. I would really appreciate it if you can subscribe. If you haven't, I'm trying to get to 2,000. So thanks for helping me do that. Every day I post a short video. If you have the wherewithal to share it, that would be amazing. I really appreciate it. And thanks for hanging out. Now I get to have fun and go back and read all the things that you guys were saying the whole time. Apparently Walter has some good dad jokes, so I'm going to be chuckling as I read all the comments from today. So thanks for being here. We'll be back again tomorrow. It's Travel Tuesday. We'll take another trip together, which will be really fun. Again, the Nikki Maduro Show, it's a 10 to 15 minute chunk. That's at 10 o'clock, followed by the 2 hour long Mark Thompson Show from 11 to 1-ish. And this show starts right after that one. So thank you for your patience on that. And I will see you tomorrow. Until then, I hope you have a really great afternoon. Make it a great day, and I'll see you right back here. Bye, everyone.
The After Party Live would like to thank the following contributors and viewers like you.